When Women Invented Television. Really good book. I really enjoyed it. I read it and I was challenged as to how we're going to get all of this in that should be in. So
yes.
Why don't you give us that? The thing I just played there was a segment from one of the early topics and early women in your book. The show was called The Goldbergs, and it started out on radio and went other places. But Jennifer, give us a thumbnail sketch of the four women you decided to use in the book to demonstrate the women who invented television.
Sure. I'll start with Gertrude Berg, since we started there with the Goldbergs.
Yeah.
That was her show on the radio. I loved hearing that introduction from her radio days. And she brought it to television in 1949. And really, what was sort of extraordinary about this is just, you know, she was an incredibly powerful woman in radio, and she recognized that, but she also really recognized the coming power of television. It wasn't quite there yet. You know, people didn't have TVs then. They were really, really expensive and big and hard to get. And so, but she kind of saw it coming and realized, you know, her sitcom on the radio had wound down. It had been on for 17 years. And, you know, she had been voted the most trusted woman in America besides Eleanor Roosevelt, to give you a sense of how big she was at that time, and was having trouble actually getting the television executives to give her another shot on television, and had kind of gotten turned down by all of the big networks that were working in TV then. But she finally just gave, you know, she finally just kind of decided, like, all right, this is enough and I'm not giving up. And so she marched into the office of William Paley, who was in charge of CBS at the time and whose network on radio she had been on for a long time. And she said, listen, you're going to need to give me a television show. I got your network through the Depression and you owe me this. And it worked. And she got herself on television and had basically TV's first family sitcom. And it was a huge success for those early days. It was, you know, at the top of the ratings charts. Yeah. She was incredibly popular. She had a line of house dresses. She had a cookbook, you know, just to give you a sense of like her celebrity at the time. So that was, you know, it's shocking to me that everybody doesn't, you know, currently remember her name, because she really did bring the sitcom to life on television and had, you know, it was the first TV show that was then made into a movie because it was so successful. So,
yeah, and all were very successful.
Right, right.
Yeah.
So that it's just, there are reasons that I get into in the book that we can talk about in a little bit that kind of threw her off course as TV just came into its own.
Right.
But that just gives you a sense of, like, at that time, and it's, to me, extraordinary, too, that she did this when she was 50 years old. You know, she was like, listen, I should be one of TV's first stars, and that's the way it's going to be. And so she had this family sitcom called The Goldbergs about a Jewish family living in a Bronx tenement. And it's very funny. It's very watchable. It's like, I mean, the quality is not great on the early episodes, but in terms of just, like, its entertainment value, it's incredible. And she wrote, starred, and produced all the shows, and she obviously created it as well. So it's one other way that she is just this incredible powerhouse that is wildly under-recognized, I think, today.
Yeah, well, no doubt about it. And this is at a time when radio is still there, of course, but television is in its early stages. And there were plenty of people who tried to make a transition from radio to television, and it didn't work. And so the idea that this sitcom that was, would you describe it as a sitcom even when it was on the radio?
I think so. I mean, they had different, they had funny terminology for a lot of, they called a lot of these soap operas, strangely enough. They've considered that a broader term, but what they meant was it was sort of serialized, like that you come back week after week, or you know, sometimes it was multiple times a week. And yes, it was essentially, though, what we would now recognize as a sitcom, which is to say, here's a situation, we're making it kind of fun and relatable and a little bit funny.
Right. And it's a whole new medium. And that when anything like that breaks, it's like the Wild Wild West. I mean,
exactly.
There's not a lot of rules going on, and it's sort of make it up as you go. And if you don't have the gumption to get into the biz, then you obviously you're not going to make it. But she was like a powerhouse.
I mean, she was incredible. I mean, I think she's incredibly inspiring just to know that she did all of this, you know, back in the late 40s and early 50s. That's the part that's really, you know, this woman was not messing around, and she was not cowed by the fact that she was a woman, you know, and this is a time when she could have been, but she had an unusually helpful and supportive husband. Mm-hmm. She did have kids. They were grown by then. But she really just was a force. And a funny thing about her, too, just as a side note, is that, you know, she was this Jewish mother character on the show and really went out of her way to kind of portray herself that way in public as well as kind of America's favorite Jewish mother. But for instance, so she had like a cookbook that she put out that was a huge success, but she didn't cook in real life. She didn't have time. She had a cook for that. So it was that kind of, and she dressed up beautifully in real life. But then she had this line of house dresses that was very affordable that she was sort of selling to the women who were more like her character than like herself.
Well, she sounds like every major star today, just about. Merchandising, brilliant. You know, clothing line, who knows what else. And certainly is certainly one of those untold stories that should be told, because the whole concept of her whole structure of how she did her show was first and is still being used today. As many of the examples in this book go back to that era, the late 40s and into the 50s, but when television started, but these women who we're talking about in this book, their contributions have lasted decades, and we'll do more of that, a lot more of it, when we come back on 720 WGN.
The new Dawes brings you The Guiding Light, created by Erna Phillips.
That's right, The Guiding Light, created by Erna Phillips. And Erna Phillips is one of the four women whose story is related in the book When Women Invented Television. And the author, Jennifer Keeshan Armstrong, is with us. And The Guiding Light, which was that was an old clip from radio that I played, was on radio for how long?
I mean, it was on like since the 40s, and then it went on to TV. Like that was the thing that was,
and it went on forever.
And it went on forever. It held a record for like longest running. I won't get the like specifics right, but basically one of the longest running TV shows ever. Well, not even TV shows, because it went before TV. So it's like longest running dramas that was broadcast. And Erna Phillips, a Chicago girl, actually created that and created the soap opera in general there in Chicago on the radio. And so she's another one of these stories where she started out on the radio and worked hard to bring her success over to television. It wasn't just like, oh, you know, go right on over and this is easy. She really believed in the idea of the daytime soap opera on television. People did not, you know, the executives did not believe it would work. They actually were concerned that women would want to do their housework and wouldn't want to sit down and watch soaps on television and be distracted, you know, that they'd like to listen to it but not watch it. Uh-huh. And Erna had a lot of ideas about how to do that correctly and really kind of fought for it. And eventually The Guiding Light was actually her first big success story in coming over to television. She had one before that called These Are My Children that was the first ever soap opera on television, but it flopped. But Guiding Light was a huge success, and they actually had this very clever thing where they brought it over directly and kept simulcasting it on the radio. So radio could come over.
It would be on radio and TV at the same time.
Yeah, and they would just, same actors, you know, so they just have one like session, but it was, one was engineered for radio and one was engineered for television. So that was kind of clever, and a number of other shows followed suit with that. She also did, was, had the idea, the radical idea of expanding soap operas from 15 to 30 minutes, and had to fight for that, but eventually got it. So
when you say she invented the soap opera too, you're also including the organ music, for lack of a better term, that we've associated with soap operas. I mean, that's her idea. I mean, it wasn't just a story. She had like the production elements down.
The whole thing. So really the thing I often tell people about now is, like, there's this skit on Saturday Night Live called The Californians where they're making fun of soap operas. Yeah. And they have, like, what they're making fun of is still essentially what Erna invented, exactly. Right? Which is the dramatic music cues, the dramatic pauses. She loved that, where they look at each other after a line is delivered and there's music. she had these great, I was, you know, looking at her archive for research, and she'd have these script notes for other writers and say, make better use of dramatic pauses. This also made the show last a little longer, which was advantageous because these actors had to memorize lines every day. So they had a lot of lines. And so if you could just stretch it out a little more.
And a lot of these shows were done in conjunction with sponsors. I mean, literally, the sponsors ran the show, so to speak.
Yes. And this is hugely important in early television. You had that in both of the spots, the radio spots in there that you played, and that came over to television. So this idea that, like, for instance, with Gertrude Berg, who we were talking about before, Sanka Coffee was her sponsor early on. And so there would be these integrated commercials, right? She would do them in character within the show and then, like, turn back to the action and talk to people some more. So this becomes really important because the you know, sponsors have so much control, which means they really control who's on the show, what's going on, everything about its future in a way that we're not really used to now. You know, an advertiser can pull out now, but it's not the same as these people were, you know, looking at scripts on the set. Yeah. They were really responsible for the show.
Right. Script supervision, they had to okay everything from A to Z, and which made it even more incredible that anything got done. But that, you know, and that hasn't changed that much, quite frankly. But Erna Phillips is the writer and creator of these soaps. She's not the talent, right? Yeah,
right. That's correct. Yes.
Yeah, I just want to make sure that people understand that we've moved from somebody who Gertrude Berg, who was the creator and the talent and the writer, to Erna Phillips, who was a writer, but invented literally the soap opera, which,
exactly.
I mean, how well have soap operas done since then? I mean, when you talk about...
Yeah, I mean, that's incredible. Like, until pretty recently, they were a huge force.
Yes, that's right. Okay, now, moving along. Now, wait a minute. I got to get this. This is what I want to... Here we go. Yeah. These are the piano stylings of Hazel Scott, whose hands were insured with Lloyd's of London. And I know that because I've read this book.
That's right.
Here is a really interesting story, and I'm sure most people do not know it. So please enlighten us all on Hazel Scott.
Absolutely. I love to do that because she's just another one. I feel like I say this about all of them, and I'm like, whatever one I'm talking about is my favorite, but... Like Gertrude Berg, especially to me, she was a superstar. You know, I describe her as the Beyonce of her time. Mm-hmm. She was this beautiful woman who had been performing since she was a teenager. She was at this point, you know, in her late 20s, early 30s, but, you know, just an enormous star. She was a jazz musician. You just were playing some of her piano work, and that was what she was known for. Specifically, she could play two pianos at once, two grand pianos. That was one trick she did. And the other thing that she did that people loved is she did something called swinging the classics. So she'd start out playing a Bach song the way she's expected to.
Yeah.
And then she'd kind of start making it boogie-woogie and jazzy, and that was like the cool thing to do at the time. So she was a huge star. She was also married to Adam Clayton Powell Jr., who was a congressman up in Harlem and a superstar, too. He was incredibly handsome, charismatic. They were both big civil rights activists. They were would use their platforms to try to advocate to end. This is still the Jim Crow era. Yeah. They were both black. They were very outspoken and kind of worked together in this way a lot of the time. You know, she wouldn't play a segregated concert venue, for instance, and she would walk out. If she walked in and saw that it was segregated, she'd walk out on her scheduled performance and, you know, kind of call the press and, you know, knowingly do this. And so she was just really brilliant and, you know, very popular, very well known. And around this time in 1950, the Dumont Network, the fourth network to ABC, CBS, and NBC, they were kind of trying to make a splash, and she is a great way to make a splash. So they offered her the chance to do her own variety show, evening variety show, where she would play. And started out just local in New York City, which is where she lived. And she loved this because this meant she could stay off the road and just play there, you know, play her show in New York City, be with her young son at the time. This was great for her. And it was so popular, it expanded to multiple days a week in New York, and then it expanded to national and was really very much on track to be very successful. And it made her the first black person to have a national primetime show that they hosted, period. Wow. Like, yeah. That's it. And it's another one where it's incredible that we do not know her name.
I want to play one more clip here of the fourth individual and then backtrack a little bit. This is somebody I think most people will recognize.
You're gonna make it after all.
Good morning, Lou.
Oh, good morning, Sue Ann. Ted will brief you.
Sue Ann, park it over here. That's the camera. When the red light goes on, that means that the camera is about...
I know what I'm doing. Just cue me and then stick a sock in it.
Yes! That is... That's Betty White on the Mary Tyler Moore Show, and Betty White is the fourth woman to be given the profile in your book. And obviously, I think to most people around today, the most recognizable name of all four, simply because she's been at it continually since she started. And her story is equally incredible. You got to get this book because, I mean, here is Betty White in like 1949, 1950, right? Getting a job mm-hmm. on a local TV station, being live for like 5 hours a day. Did I read that correctly?
5.5 hours a day.
5.5 hours
a week.
Ad-libbing.
6 days a week. Yes.
Unbelievable.
It really, it is. And I think that knowing that explains a lot about Betty White to me.
Yeah.
Because, so she was on one of the first talk shows ever in Los Angeles and became, that was really where she made her first mark. It's really where she became a star. And for good reason, because my God, so she was a co-host on this show with a DJ named Al Jarvis. And this is really, you talked about the Wild West of early television. To me, this is the best indicator of that, right? Because they're like, we don't know what to do all day. So how about you watch this lady? And it turns out the answer is, yes, we will do that. That's great. And it really shows you why she's so quick on her feet, you know, at even 99 years old.
Oh, because, it's amazing. Yeah.
You know, she had a lot of practice. She's really, and if you watch, the super early stuff is not available on tape, but some of, you know, you can get like her 1954 national talk show, which she kind of graduated to. And watching some of those clips, she'll look directly into the camera and just deliver her lines and talk to you, and you just feel so seen. She really was a star from the beginning.
Let's go, talk about, in the time that we have left, which unfortunately is not much, what this environment, though, was for all of these women and many others in the mid-50s in the United States with the Army-McCarthy hearings, the House Un-American Activities Committee. And when I read in the book that they went after Betty White, I'm like, what? you know, this was the communist, what? A menace. And it was, yes. allegedly everywhere, and McCarthyism, and we're going to root out the commies from the army and everywhere else, and blacklist artists. And, I mean, it was a battle to survive for all of these
women. It really was. And I sort of say it as, like, in, I think 1955 was the critical year when kind of, like, you know, we're at peak Eisenhower era. It's sexism, it's racism, and it's this communist witch hunt, which literally took down directly two of these women. And the two that we were marveling at should be much more famous, Gertrude Berg and Hazel Scott. Hazel was blacklisted in 1950, that year that she had that great success with her talk show or her variety show. And soon, you know, she actually chose to speak up against it. And she went before HUAC, the committee, and, you know, told them exactly what they were doing wrong, and this did not go over well.
No kidding.
So her show was, as we noted with the sponsor, suddenly the sponsor, that no one could find the sponsor. Where did the sponsor go? And unfortunately, she was really marginalized and eventually actually moved to Paris for a while and was really happy there. But, you know, I think that really took her off the American radar, and I think she could have been a huge force in early television if she had been allowed to continue.
Right, and it underscores the entire book. When Women Invented Television, The Untold Story of the Female Powerhouses Who Pioneered the Way We Watch Today, how do we make sure that we buy the book, Jennifer? How do we do that?
Well, you can pre-order the book now on any of the platforms you love online, Amazon et al., bookshop.org. And it is available next week, March 23rd, anywhere books are sold.
Thank you so much for being with us. Great talking to you.
Thank you.